Hello, everyone, and welcome to another installment of Investing with IBD Podcast. It's Justin Yielsen, your host, and it's March 15th, 2023. Beware the Ides of March. That's going to be kind of one of our themes today. I'm also joined, as I am always joined, by Arusha Pieris. He's a portfolio manager over at O'Neill Global Advisors. How are you doing today, Arusha?
I'm doing well, Justin. I like the little beware of Ides of March.
a little throwback to Shakespeare and Julius Caesar, all of that. And then, of course, we also have as our special guest today, joining us again, it's John Kosar. John Kosar, he's a chief market strategist at Asbury Research, really great at the technical breakdown of what's happening in charts and all the action behind that. Has got some really interesting models that we've talked about on this show before, including the Asbury 6, the SIEF model. So we'll be getting into some of that stuff, but welcome back to the show, John.
Thanks. Great to be here, guys.
Okay, so let's get right into it. I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about the market and how money is just really not finding a home right now. It's looking, but you know, we have to address this market. And certainly one of the things that is top of mind for investors right now is what's happened with the banks. Of course, over the weekend, SIVB, that one, you know, it failed. It didn't open on Friday, was halted and just stopped trading. Signature Bank in New York also failed, and those have both been taken over. So what is the effect here on the market here, John? What does this kind of portend for us? Is this a big event, or is this kind of a non-event that we just have to kind of get through?
You know, the only one that I trust that knows the answer to that is the market. And right, because you know there's tons of stuff to read and watch, but the market has to figure this out. And interestingly, this indecision has been here since December. You see it in the sector rotations. The market doesn't know quite where to put its money. So this took a market that was already kind of shaky, and it pushed it over the cliff, so to speak. So I think that's what we're looking at. It's driving the headlines right now. Obviously, it has an effect on the energy market right now. So there's ancillary effects to failures in the banking system that have everybody spooked.
Yeah, and that being said, you've seen these banks, a number of banks going under, a lot of fear in the market, potential bank runs, people getting very nervous, lines out the doors of a number of these banks. But the market opened down, what, 1% or so today, but it was able to come back. What does that tell you anything, John?
It tells me the market is recognizing some of these levels that are really important. We're going to take a look at those in just a few minutes. But the market's backed up to some levels. After peaking at the beginning of February, it started to weaken internally. We'll take a look at that too. But we're at some places in a couple of key indexes that if we can't hold here, it opens the door for a lot bigger decline. And that's where the market has to figure out just how much more damage is out there as a result of the banking issue right now, and how the market negotiates these levels is going to tell us what it thinks. And I think that's what to pay attention to.
So I know that you like to look at the S&P 500 as kind of your big gauge. And you, of course, look at the different sector spider ETFs, that make up the S&P 500. So maybe we start with there and kind of talk about some of these levels. And Arusha can pull up the PowerPoint because you have some charts. And so just as a reminder for folks that, again, we're going to get a little bit into some charts and some levels that are important. And that means there's going to be some visual components. I know there's a lot of folks that listen in, but you might want to take a look at www.investors/podcast for some of the charts that John has provided us today, because the levels that we're talking about, as he said, are kind of important. And if they hold, that's great. And if they don't, look out below, I guess. Yeah, so go ahead, John. Tell us what we're looking at here, because you've got a lot of lines on this chart. And
there's a lot going on here. So I'm going to try to explain it rather than make it so important to just kind of see everything. So we were in a major downtrend all of last year, as everybody knows. Everybody was watching the 200-day moving average. And there was other, there was a trend line that went, that started at the January high of 2022. So we bumped into that trend line and tested it from underneath in August. If you're looking at the chart, it's at the extreme left.
Where it kind of hit its head on top of there, right?
Yeah, just on top there, August. So that was a retest of the 200-day moving average where the market was trying to figure out if it was still a downtrend or not. So it was. And then we dropped right down to, let's call it 3,600. The actual level is 3,588. That was the high that we made in the S&P 500 back in September 2020. So we held there. We tested it once on September 30th. We broke through it just a little bit in October. And then we went right back up to the 200-day moving average again. Tested it two times in the beginning and the middle of December. Fell back a little bit. And then finally on January the 23rd, we broke through the resistance. And it was something everybody was looking at. Everybody was focusing on it all of last year. So it was an event. It was a big deal to get through there. So we rallied a little bit up into the February 2nd high, right around 4,200. And then we started to roll over. And we noticed here, market internals started to turn weak. Third week of February, we started to see money coming out of SPY. We started to see corporate bond spreads starting to widen a little bit. Breadth was getting weaker. All these symptoms were starting to show up. And so we broke back down into the 200-day moving average, which is now a support level. Let's call it 3,900, just to make it simple. Tried to rally off of there, failed. And then we had the issue with banking, right? That's when the banking issue showed up just a few days ago. And March 9th, the S&P actually fell through its 200-day moving average downward. That meant that you couldn't look at that January breakout anymore without wondering if it was still valid. Did the market change its mind? Did something happen between the end of January and the beginning of March? It obviously did. So the last thing I wanted to show here is 3850 down to 3760. That's 50% and 61.8% back from that entire rally that started on October the 13th and ended in February 2. That level has to hold in order for technicians to still make the argument that this was just a pullback in an emerging trend higher. So that's where we tested today. Today, the low was, maybe 3,800-ish was the low in the S&P 500, right in the middle of those two areas. And then we had a strong close. We closed up near the highs of the day. That tells me the market sees it. What it does with it now over the next couple of days is going to tell the story. If we can't hold this level, I think it's very likely that we can go all the way back to that 3,600 level that I talked about at the very beginning when I was kind of laying out the way this chart looks.
Test of that September 2020 high all the way down there. Yeah.
Yeah. So, John, quickly, Justin, before that January 23, when it got above resistance, why were you using that as specific resistance versus something else? Was it... it just got above the 200, came back in a little bit, and then now made a higher high above the 200?
Yeah, it was the first solid close that we had. And there's another line there that I didn't put in because I've already got probably five already, right? But there's a trend line that starts at the January 4th high of 2022. And it crossed kind of right adjacent to the 200-day moving average. So you make a judgment call and you look at it. It looks like we tried to get through it. Beginning of January, we sold off in the January 19th, and then we took another run at it. And like Arusha said, we made a slightly higher high. And if I had the trend line drawn in, you would have seen that it was a clean break. So that's to me looked like, and then there was other stuff going on at that time too. Our Asbury 6, it was green and it turned positive. So that told me that the market internals underneath that moved through the resistance was giving the market some horsepower. I didn't know how long it would last. It turned out it only lasted until the beginning of February. But when we look at the chart, we look at these market internals to try to qualify these moves. Is this just a little jerk that we're getting from the algos, or is this the real deal and there's something going on under the hood of the market? And that was the case on Jan 23.
And it certainly felt a little bit different this time. I mean, you know, the move off the bottom in October, it was strange, right? That the Dow Jones Industrial Average was the leading index for so long from that October bottom. But in January, it really was like the NASDAQ had taken over. Growth names were coming back. Technology was back in favor. Now, granted, a lot of these were coming off their bottoms. You had a number of the Chinese stocks, you know, kind of participating as well and going up as reopening was kind of the flavor of the month. What does that kind of tell you? That was this just another fake out, or does that remain to be seen? You know, again, you kind of laid out some levels here for us. What's your feeling here? Is it still a growth oriented market? Because technology certainly seems like it's holding up a little bit better right now.
That's the interesting and difficult to understand part of this. You made a really good point. After we made the bottom in October, the rally up to the D's highs, that was led by the Dow 30. So the Dow 30 was outperforming the S&P. The S&P was outperforming the NASDAQs. Value was outperforming growth. It was obviously, the market saw it as a defensive rally. So instead of rushing into tech, it was staying with the burrows, you know, the Dow 30 rather than the racehorses, the two NASDAQs. So that was just a rally that the market had handicapped to be a correction in an unfinished down move. In January, it was different. You started seeing performance by tech. Tech was outperforming the S&P. S&P was outperforming the Dow. High beta stocks started to do better. Growth has recently started to do better over value. So yeah, there was quality in that January 23rd move higher that suggested the market was changing its perception of what kind of a rally this was. This was a rally where you were seeing some risk on. You were seeing people looking to add some alpha and not kind of begrudgingly be in the rally like from October to D's, where managers still had to be in the market if it was going up, but they were buying the Dow and not the tech indexes.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, to that idea of risk on, maybe we take a look at the Russell 2000 as well, because the Russell 2000, the small cap index, a lot of times people think of that as kind of a risk on. And it was also doing very well during this time period. It was having some outperformance. And then, of course, we had this whole banking issue, and you know, here we go. It's you know, the financials do make up a big part of this Russell 2000 index, like 15%. And of course, you have the particularly vulnerable regional banks that, you know, make up that part. It's not the JP Morgans that are the financials in the Russell 2000. It's the regional banks. So, what's your take on this risk on here with the Russell 2000?
Exactly what I was thinking was, this is more of a risk on place. You know, this is where investors are going to go if they want to get a little bit more, beta, take a little bit more risk than just buying the S&P 500. And I've been staring at this chart for some time. And basically what happened here was we've got a giant, very important support level from that is from the August 2018 peak of 1742. And then a couple of years later, we had another similar peak in January of 2020 at 1715, right? So we tested it last year four times, May 13th, June 17th, October 14th, and D's 30. And a couple of times it was broken a little bit for a week or two, and then it came right back. So that's telling me the market really thinks that this level's a big deal. So then we had our rally in February, and at that time, small cap was leading. You know, that was kind of that risk-on thing that we had that went along with the January breakout in the S&P 500. We collapsed back through it to the downside a couple of over the past 2 weeks, and guess where we are? We're right on that 1742 to 1715 again. That's the what the sixth time in less than a year that we're on this level. Why is it important? Because the market sees it. That's why you're seeing all these bottoms here. The market thinks it's important, thinks it's an inflection point, and the Russell tends to be kind of the tip of the spear, right? When people want to take more risk, they're going to go to the Russell. If people want to play defense, they're not going to be in the Russell. They're going to go to the Dow 30 or some other similar index, or you know, the NYSE composite, something like that. So if we break through here more than just a week, something where we spend a couple of weeks underneath here, or we make a significant move down through these old lows that we made in June and October, that opens the door up for a much bit bigger and more aggressive move down in the Russell. So to me, I have my eye on this chart once an hour. I just want to see what the Russell
is. Just making sure.
And so, John, so with the Russell being testing these levels over and over again, six times in the last year, is that increasing the odds that it's going to actually break past that 1750 level and maybe take out the lows from the October 14?
Objectively, it does. But I don't know that there's any clean data that would indicate that. I think you might be sure. You know, the more time a level is hit, you know, the more likely it's going to eventually fall through. But this is the scariest chart that we're going to look at today, because if we break here, it's going to indicate kind of a capitulation, let's call it. After trying to hold this for almost a year, five, six times it's hit it. If it fails, this is going to be a canary in a coal mine that we could be in for a tough second quarter.
And maybe, I mean, when I look at this chart, because it was a straight up from March 2020, sometimes when they go straight up, they can come straight down if they haven't spent a lot of time at those levels. So, I mean, that's kind of the first thing that I worry about if it starts breaking that is, like, does it kind of accelerate and maybe test some of those levels a little quicker than we anticipate?
And, you know, from a time standpoint, so we looked at the S&P 500. We're also on some pretty important support. This suggests to me that this should resolve itself one way or another, maybe by the end of the month, early part of April. I don't think it's going to spend a whole lot of time here. It's the fifth time it's been down here in a relatively short period of time. So that tells me that you need to pay a lot more of attention to the other indicators you might pay attention to, whether they might be the VIX or relative performance, asset flows, because this is telling you the market has to make a big decision.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the sectors that are coming into play here, how the money is trying to find a home. And John will get into all of that when we come back. Stay tuned.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Okay, welcome back to the Investing with IBD podcast. It's Justin Nielsen, your host, along with Arusha Pierce, who joins me every week. He is a portfolio manager over at O'Neill Global Advisors. And our special guest this week is John Kosar, coming back to the show. He's chief market strategist at Asbury Research. So John, let's get into this a little bit more about this sector rotation. And I guess if we kind of start with the big picture view and just look at how the NASDAQ has been outperforming lately, what strikes you the most about this outperformance that the NASDAQ's had?
It strikes me the most because it's counter to everything else that I've been seeing really since the middle to latter part of February. where you start to see the market starts falling apart a little bit. And you're seeing just signs of internal weakness all over the place. But in the meantime, since January the 20th, you could see on that chart down on the bottom, it has outperformed SPY by 7%. Typically, when I see the market rally, I like to see who the leaders are. I like to see if it's a defensive rally like the one that we had from October to almost the end of last year, or if it's an offense. So if you're looking at this, it looks like an offensive rally, buying the NDX. The NDX is a typical leader when there's risk appetite, when things are risk on. And you've been seeing kind of more muted relative outperformance coming from the semiconductors. And in fact, just I was looking today, over the past 2, 3, 4 days, you've seen underperformance from the Dow. So you've got the relative performance looks in some ways like an uptrend, a risk on kind of a place where tech's outperforming, semis are doing okay, and underperformance is coming from places like the Dow 30 and maybe the NYSC Composite Index. So that's one of the oddities about what we're seeing here. And I think it just kind of plays into the theme. The market's not sure what to make of this rally that we had at the end of January. I think there's still, well, certainly until we had the financial, the banks issue over the past several days, I think there's a lot of uncertainty in the market. I've seen it in a number of different ways where the market isn't quite sure of what to do here. If this rally went too far and we're still in the midst of a downtrend from last year, or if we're making some kind of a sea change. And you see it in things like relative performance.
So do you think possibly that maybe with the financials cracking and a number of other sectors cracking, that there might be a flight to safety more towards kind of these large cap tech stocks? Like people feel a little bit more comfortable buying an Apple and parking money there until things settle down. Do you think that's what could be going underneath the surface?
That's certainly a viable reason for this. I mean, I was looking through some of the largest stocks earlier today, and Apple and Microsoft are two that have either broken through a major resistance level or held a major support level. You're seeing relative outperformance. You're seeing quarterly relative outperformance versus the S&P 500. So that could be very well what's going on here, is the market isn't sure of where to be. So it's going to the 800-pound gorillas.
Yeah, and there was certainly a lot of decent performance. I mean, those were holding up the best for a while, it seemed like, today. I mean, Meta platforms, Netflix, Microsoft, Apple, as you mentioned. I mean, I was looking at the NASDAQ 100 and looking at some of the, you know, the better performers of the NASDAQ 100. And yeah, it was a lot of those big cap, or mega cap, I guess I should say. And again, getting back to your original point about the Russell 2000 kind of being the canary in the coal mine, it does seem to be giving a mixed signal. Risk off, according to the Russell, risk on, according to the NASDAQ and tech. But talk to me a little bit about this next chart. And I know that you follow a lot of the money. And where is the money going? Where is the money going in sectors?
Let me jump in here just a second if I can.
Sure.
Yeah. I wanted to point out, look where we are in the NDX. We're sitting right on the 200-day moving average. It's at 12,200, right? So when you see a big support level being hit in one place, you like to see it in other places. So it's just not a one-trick pony. It's something that's going on within the market. So this is just another indication and another level for us to watch over the next week or so, 12,200 in the NDX. If this outperformance that we're seeing is has legs, we should hold this support and start making fresh highs here over the next week or two. And if we don't, then you've got to take another look and wonder what's happening.
That's a very good point. And we should also remind our listeners that the NDX is the NASDAQ 100, which does take out it's the largest NASDAQ composite companies minus the financials. So you take out the financials, and that's one of the reasons why the NASDAQ 100 is, of course, holding up a little bit better and holding above that 200-day moving average line, whereas a lot of the other indexes are not. So yeah, let's go ahead and pivot over to the Qs, the NASDAQ 100. This is the ETF for the NASDAQ 100. QQQ is the ticker symbol. What is this chart showing us in terms of following where the money is going?
So we have the NDX up on top going back to November, and we have the 200 moving average also there again. And here on the bottom, we have QQQ and the total net assets invested in Q. And all that is shares outstanding multiplied by NAV. And that is giving you what we call total net assets. I like to watch these. I came from the futures space. I spent 17 years on the floor of Chicago Mercantile Exchange in the 1980s and 1990s when things were roaring and they had launched the S&P 500, you know, during that period. And I was used to looking at futures open interest. Volume tells you urgency, right? Who's trading during the day? And a lot of that is algorithmic trading now, taking that over the stock market. Showing conviction is the guys buying these and holding them overnight. So you're taking the overnight risk, and that's what this chart shows for me. So what you see here is that from January the 11th to February the 17th, these assets expanded over their 21-day moving average, which again is our tactical time period. During that period, we had a nice rally in NDX. We had a nice rally in the Qs. Then what happens from February 21st through yesterday, or through a couple of days ago, it fell back underneath the 21-day. It indicated monthly contraction, and that's when NDX fell back into the 200-day moving average. It went slightly up above it yesterday, just slightly up above it, not enough to tell me that we have a trend change. I'm going to be watching this data tomorrow. I'll get the data tomorrow morning early. And if we have a big explosion in there where there was a lot of new money that went into the Qs and held them overnight, it's going to tell me I might not feel so squeamish about trying to buy NDX here and leaning on that support level because I've got some horsepower underneath me. I've got some asset flows going back into the Qs.
And so even just with the 21-day kind of in a downtrend there, the fact that it's just getting above the Qs on the total net assets, that's enough of a reason to take a little bit of a chance.
Very tactical, right? You can see by the chart, those of you that can't see the chart, it's tactical. It's 21 days. That trend will change sometimes every 4, 5, 6 weeks. But when I see monthly expansion, sometimes you see a breakout on the chart and it just might be the algo guys having some fun on a Tuesday and a Wednesday, right? But if you see those assets expand, either in SPY or Q, or I actually use those for our SIF model, it tells you, it shows me conviction. It shows me overnight conviction. And I think that's important. Mm-hmm.
So you kind of talked about, you know, if that trend can be broken, if the total net assets can kind of break that 21-day line trend and start showing a little bit more of that overnight holding, that kind of reduces your squeamishness. Maybe kind of thinking of squeamishness, we could take a look at the VIX. And how are you using the VIX with all of this? The VIX, of course, is taking the implied volatility of the S&P 500, you know, with the options market. And we've seen a big spike in that. It's often called the fear index. So a lot of action below 20, which was making people think, okay, are people getting complacent here? Then we had a spike up here above 30. What is this telling you in terms of your squeamishness factor, I guess?
Well, I look at the VIX as being very tactical, just as asset flows might be tactical in the Qs or in SPY. So we overlay a 21-day moving average. And what this chart shows is it goes back to December of last year, and it shows that the last three times, three of the past four times that the VIX was up above its 21-day moving average was D7 to Jan 5, We had a nice move down in the S&P 500 during that period. It was about a two-week move down. And then again on Feb 8 to March 1st, we had another move down in the S&P. And now this third one is from March 9th, where it was a pretty violent spike higher. So the way that I look at this is I'm not going to feel really comfortable putting money back to work in the stock market, in the S&P 500, in the overall market until the VIX calms down and shows me that that fear has abated. And for that to happen, I'd like to see the VIX get back down underneath its 21-day moving average, which is currently at 21.45. And the VIX right now is right around 30, just eyeballing this chart.
Yeah, you know what? What's also kind of now that I really like that 21-day using that over on the VIX. I mean, what's also kind of interesting is that this is the first time on this chart since December that the VIX really went crazy, right? The other times the S&P came down quite a bit, but the VIX didn't kind of have the normal fear that we've been used to. Is there anything else going on here? Why all of a sudden you have much wider and larger ranges?
Well, I think if you see on the chart, it shows that the VIX moved back up above its 21-day on March 9th. That was right when the financial, the banking situation it was hitting, and the financials were getting crushed, and everybody was nervous about that. I'm actually looking at another chart now, and what I'm looking at is the VIX got up to a couple of days ago, it got up to, let's call it 31. Previous times that the VIX has gotten up to 33, 34, those were bottoms in the S&P 500. So we didn't quite get the VIX high enough to get that cathartic scare, I guess, and really get the market to that degree, but it got reasonably close. So like I'm looking back here, back in the end of September, VIX was up around 35. June, right around the June lows, it was up around 35. Going back further, right around March, middle of March of last year. So VIX is kind of a double-edged sword here. So right now it's telling me the market is a little too nervous to put new money to work, but it's also telling me that it's close to that extreme fear level where you can start to look for bottom. So now we're going back to those support levels, right, that we were looking at. The VIX starts to come in from here. Those support levels start to hold. We see some asset flow going back into the queues. Now we've got something to work with in three different spots.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it's time to pivot to kind of, okay, what's looking like it's holding up? Where is the money going? And what is kind of the projection? You've kind of given us some of your support levels, but what data specifically are you looking for to kind of tell you everything's okay? Is it a combination of all of these things? I mean, you've talked about the VIX, the asset flows. What is it that kind of tells you, hey, things are okay now, and we can start to get rid of our squeamishness and dip our toes back in the water?
That's a really great point for this particular graphic. This is our Asbury 6, and it's a metric that I built years ago when you couldn't look at the S&P 500 and maybe volume anymore and have a decent back of the envelope idea of what the condition of the market is. Up 70 today and down 70 tomorrow seems like it forces you out of your longs. And then 3 days later, you're buying new highs because you have to. And there's people on the other sides of those trades, right, that are able to capitalize on those. So I took my favorite tactical tools throughout my career. It's probably 12 of them to start. We started back testing them in groups of three and groups of five and groups of eight to see which ones play nice with the others. In other words, if one or two of these give me a bad signal, because no indicator works all the time, people ask us, what's our favorite indicator? I don't have one because they all have an Achilles heel. So we took these six, put them together, and there's stuff like stocks versus high yield bonds, relative performance, asset flows in the spider, high yield corporate bond spreads, trading volume, market breadth. And these, this is called the Asbury 6, four or more. This is updated after the close every day. It's on a research center. So four or more in one direction indicates a directional signal for the model. So this turned risk off on February 21st after being risk on since the beginning of January. All these dates here are when each of these individual metrics actually turn negative. So this tells me much more clear than looking to see what the S&P 500 did today, what the condition of the patient is. The metaphor that I use for this is like when you go to the doctor's office and he sees you come in the door and your hair's combed, you have a nice shirt on, and he makes a gut kind of idea of what condition you might get in and that be in. Then he puts you on the table, he listens to your heart and lungs, listens to your pulse, takes your blood pressure, and he might find out that you're not so good looking on the inside. And that's what this kind of helps me to do every day to determine the day-to-day health. And right now, the health of the market is as weak as this particular model will let it be.
Yeah. And a lot of these factors are not just on the technical side. You know, we do tend to focus on the technical side for our market indicators. You know, we use the follow-through days, distribution days, and I've been watching your stuff for a while, John, and it's pretty interesting how your Asbury 6 really does kind of coincide with a lot of our signals. I think, you know, we were going onto uptrend under pressure at the same time that your Asbury 6 was turning negative, like I think to the day. And the change, the follow-through day was right around the same time that your Asbury 6 went positive. It was within a few days. So why do you kind of stray a little bit from the technical here? You know, you've got corporate bond spreads and all these things that, you know, stocks versus high yield bonds that aren't on the typical chartist radar, but it's on yours. What made these kind of jump out to you?
Great. Yeah, that's a great point. When I built this, I wanted to build something that wouldn't have me chasing the tail of the S&P 500. And a lot of your regular technical analysis will do that, right? Your breakouts through, you know, whatever it might be, a support level, a moving average cross, stochastics are, MACD, they're closely tied to the S&P 500. So I had to put one indicator in here that was indicative of the S&P 500 because that's how we all get paid. So I used the 21-day rate of change here in the S&P 500, but the other ones can't be controlled day-to-day by the algos. Investor asset flows. I think a lot of these algos are not holding these positions overnight. There's a lot of day trading, obviously, that's going on there that jacks that volume up. Even for trading volume, I'm using on-balance volume, cumulative volume, which has a little bit of a different spin on it than just seeing how many shares were traded during the day, market breadth, relative performance, again, between stocks and bonds. I was trying to get more to the under-the-hood condition of the market and not staring at the S&P 500 and getting faked out every third day, which was kind of what happens now.
Yeah, right. Well, and it kind of goes back to your initial point of this, this money, the trend really hasn't been there. You know, the money is going into some stuff. It stays there for a little while, a day or two sometimes, and then it's out of there onto the next thing. And, we can certainly get into that a little bit. Why don't you talk a little bit as kind of like an introduction to that about your SEEF model, because that really is about the where is the money flowing to a large degree.
Built SEEF, this is probably another model 5 or 6 years old. And the reason that I built it is it used to be, I've been around a while, so it's like back in the old days, but it used to be where your trends and sector rotation would last a quarter or two. So you had enough time to see it on a chart, to see the relative performance start to get better, and then to get on that trend and maybe be on the trend for a quarter, 6, 7, 8 weeks. And then you'd see the chart start to turn and maybe the money moves to another sector. You had time to do that. You don't anymore. Everything is sped up. So I needed to figure out, I either had to stop doing sector rotation or figure out a faster, more agile way to see these moves in the market. So what I did was built a model that measures the velocity of money moving into and out of these sector spiders. There's 11 of them. And I did it in three different time frames. You can see we have trading, which is 5 days, tactical 21 days, which I said is our tactical time period, and strategic, which is a quarter, 63 days. And then what we do is we look for trends that are going across the time periods. So you can see, like, if you look at the one on top, we have energy that was ranked 4 in terms of trading. Over the past week, it was the 4th best in terms of assets moving aggressively into that sector. Tactical, it was number 1. Strategic, it was number 1. Where is it this week? It's getting creamed, right? And we're going to see those assets left there and went somewhere else. So what normally happens in a normal market is the market kind of, it flits around from sector to sector until it finds a place it likes, and then it stays there. And that's where the SIEF model really does well. Typically what happens in a normal year, at least normal over the past 3 or 4 years tracking this model, is during the course of a year, you'll have 15 signals. One was +3, the other one you lost 3. It outperformed by 3, underperformed by 3, outperformed by 4, underperformed by 2. And then you have 3 during the, like energy was last year. So everything else just kind of X's each other out, and you catch the ones that really matter, and it helps this outperform. It's outperformed 8 of the past 10 quarters. Last year, it was in energy from Jan 10 through June 24. That was the year, that was the year for the model. And all of the rest of the stuff was up a little here, down a little here. What's happened here since December, and I haven't seen this yet, is you are seeing rapid rotation where you'll see it 3 or 4 weeks ago. This is when we were on the north side of the 200-day moving average in the S&P 500. The money was aggressively going to consumer discretionary and technology. It left there 2 weeks later, and it was in healthcare and energy, right? And then 2 weeks after that, it was back into the more aggressive places. So atypically, this is telling me, underscoring, the market isn't sure what to do here. It broke out in January, right? And it fell, and it's falling back into the support now. You could see this at the sector level, where the money continues to try to go to the place that it thinks is the place to be. 2 weeks later, it's gone and it's somewhere else. So this started in December. This just didn't start 2 weeks ago. So what's happening right now is there's a lot of consternation. I think it has to do with, are we still in a major downtrend, or are we starting a new sustainable move up? The market doesn't know. It keeps trying to find the right place to be and keeps getting disappointed.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about this whole idea of how we've been getting tossed to and fro with the sectors, the sector rotation, and that money looking for a home. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
Okay, welcome back to the Investing with IBD podcast. It's Justin Nielsen here, and I'm joined, as always, by Arusha Pieris, who is one of the portfolio managers over at O'Neill Global Advisors. And our special guest this week is John Kosar. He's from Asbury Research, chief market strategist over there, someone we've had on the show a number of times. And we were talking a little bit about this SIEF model, just kind of reminding our listeners, for those that haven't been exposed to John's work before, that he's looking at these inflows and outflows. And so we saw this table, and you have the 11 sector spiders here, John. Maybe talk a little bit about what to make of this, and again, the timing of this. Energy was number one. And maybe we can go to the next chart too to kind of show visually. So energy was kind of on the left-hand side, and we saw that getting clobbered. Financials started getting clobbered, and they're still getting clobbered, but they're all over the place. XLU, that's kind of in the yellow in the middle ground. That was up the most today. So what should people make of this movement all over the place?
Very unusual in terms of the CEIF model. I've been, it's been in existence for several years, and I can't recall seeing this kind of frenetic moving from one sector to the next and then back again, just anecdotally over the past month, maybe 6 weeks. I saw energy go from, you know, where it was through the end of last week. As you can see here, it had the best score. In other words, there was the most money, most aggressively moving into that space in multiple time periods. but just over the past 6-8 weeks, I've seen energy go from number one all the way to the backside here. You know, the ones to avoid that have a high score of 25 or more, back to number one and back again in the meantime. So you have the market is looking for the place to be, and it is very skittish and very uncertain. And I think it ties directly to what we can see on that S&P 500 chart. We broke out on January the 23rd. We couldn't hold a rally. We fell back into the support. Then you had this issue in the banking space that just basically threw gas on this thing and threw a match at it. And it was already a lot of churning, a lot of uncertainty. I think what this shows you is the market isn't sure if we're still in that downtrend from last year, or if inflation is under control, if the Fed's got a handle on this, if there's a lot of difference of opinion on what the condition of the market is, what the condition of the economy is, which tells investors how to bet on the stock market. This will change at some point. We'll see the money go into one or two or three sectors and stay there. And that's where the model is going to be effective again. But right now, it's screaming to me that this is one of those indecision areas. And what comes out of these areas is a new trend. We just don't know right now if it's up or down. But this, the next best thing to knowing what the future is going to be, which nobody does, is when we're at these big inflection points and when the market is at a uncertain state. And that's where we are right now. I'm very confident this is going to lead into the next big trend that we're going to be talking about for the next 2 quarters or more.
Now, not sure what
direction it is yet, right?
Right. Well, yeah, and going off that not knowing what direction it is, I mean, a lot of times when you have that volatility, that you see that at when a market is trying to make a bottom, and a lot of shares are going from the weak to the strong. Now, who knows if this is a bottom or not, but this is kind of, I guess, in a bear market, this might be somewhat normal action when you're getting closer.
Yeah, it's just really tough to say. The silver lining in all this, if there is one, is we know that the market's testing these big time levels.
Yeah.
And we know the VIX spiked up to a level that sometimes you'll see the market make a bottom. Everything that we looked at today indicates indecision, but there's some hard levels to look at. You see it in the Russell, you see it in the S&P, you see it in the NDX. There's some hard levels to watch here. The hardest place to make money, I think, is in that first 15 or 10% at the beginning of a move and the 10% at the end. That 80 in the middle is a lot easier to capture. And your indicators are starting to work. Now you're seeing some asset flows. You don't get paid that much more to be the first guy in the trade for it to be worth it to me. So you let this tells you consternation. This tells you that we're at a major decision point. You let some other guy that's either smarter, you know, or crazier than you to jump on this now, and let's wait till the trend develops. And that's how we're looking at this, is we see a opportunity coming here. But this is a really risky place to put new ideas on until this picture clears.
Yeah, you just need more information at this point. So very, very clear. So let's go ahead and get into a few different areas. Let's drill down a little bit more into not just the sector spiders, but some of the other areas. But before we do, I just want to kind of let people know that, again, John has a lot of great research that he offers. And what is the best way for people to kind of get access to some of this research that you have, whether it's the Asbury 6, you also have your correction protection model, the CEF model, which I don't think we ever told people what the acronym stood for.
Sector ETF asset flows.
Yes. So so where can people find this information from you?
The best way to get more information is go to our website, asburyresearch.com. We're going to offer a 10% off for our research subscriptions. We have 3-month and 12-month subscriptions for anybody who is here today and either heard us or saw us. We're going to extend that through the end of March. So you got about 2 weeks left, 10% off. Go to the website, go to the contact tab, and just put your contact info, your name, your email address, your phone number if you like. We're probably not going to call you, but you know, give us your information. And then there's a little text box there. Just put IPD podcast, and we will send you an email that will have the offer, the 10% off, bunch of links to click that will walk you around our website, show you the models, show you how they work, show you what our research looks like. And if you'd like us to call you, you know, we'd be happy to do that and answer any questions you might have.
Awesome. Thanks for that, John. So let's go ahead and we can maybe start, because we were talking a little bit during the break about what happened with the metals and miners. Maybe we start with XME, and this is another one of the S&P ETFs that we track. It's a little bit broad though, right? You've got in the metals and miners, you've got your copper, you've got gold, you've got coal in there, you've got a little bit of everything. So what was your take on this XME? And it was looking, I thought it was looking pretty good to start the year, but it's not looking so good anymore. What happened?
Oh, it fell apart. I've got a chart here also that I'm looking at. So it's been drifting sideways really since September. You know, you can see a lot of the sideways drift in the right side of the chart. Been drifting sideways. And then we got above the 200-day moving average in the beginning of January, started outperforming the S&P 500, which is, numero uno for me. I'm not interested in buying anything that's not out. Performing the market, right? Just stay in the market if that's what you want to do. But we did get some nice outperformance here in the beginning of the year. But it ended right in about the middle of February, the beginning to middle of February. We actually had a long idea there, but we were only in the idea for about 3 weeks and everything turned. You saw a lot of underperformance starting to show up in the beginning of February. That's right around the time that the S&P 500 started to unravel. So when I put this idea on, I was putting the idea on as an alternative investment to the S&P 500, and it turned out acting just like it, really. From so it kind of lost its luster for us, and right now it's fallen right back into its range. So I don't see any opportunity here. But if you look at the precious metals, those have really led up here over the past few days, and there might be some opportunity there.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we can kind of shift over to gold, and GLD kind of tracks, this is an ETF that kind of tracks the price of gold bullion. You also have the GDX, which is the miners, but it seems like right now, GLD is a little bit stronger, whereas GDX, the miners, still below the 50-day moving average line on that chart. GLD did cross above the 50-day moving average line. Now, granted, we did kind of have an event here that maybe led to some of the strength here in GLD with the banking issues going on. So talk a little bit about this kind of separation that happened between the industrial metals and the precious metals.
Yeah, gold was, we actually liked gold, and that was one of our ideas from around Thanksgiving to the beginning of February. And then what we noticed is the asset flows going into GLD started to dry up. So we kind of removed ourselves from the idea. But since then, you can see right on the right edge of that chart, the GLD came down, tested its 200-day moving average. It didn't get right on top of it, but it got in the neighborhood twice. And then we had the banking situation come up, the failed banks. And in a period where there's not a lot of the ETFs that I look at, like XME, are acting an awful lot like the S&P 500, right? Everything is starting to move up and down together. But I think gold was a safe haven. And what doesn't show in this chart, but what really caught my eye is the past couple of days, those asset flows in GLD really spiked up. So it's not only people buying it intraday or people making kind of a jerky move just to get out of stocks and buy something that isn't going down. It looks like there's been some buying there that's been held overnight. So people are taking that overnight risk staying in gold. That tells me that this move off the 200-day moving average could have legs. I think it's going to have more legs if we fall through these support levels, obviously, in the that we looked at in the NDX and in the Russell 2000. If we fall through those levels, the VIX stays elevated. The Asbury 6 stays in a negative status. This gold trade is going to really get a lot more popular. But I think they could both coexist. I mean, we had a nice rally from November to February in gold right alongside the S&P 500. So again, in a time where I've been turning over rocks trying to find something to buy, this space looks like, from what I can see right now, this looks like the best that you could do out there to find an alternative to stocks where you could put your money until the sun comes back out in the stock market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's probably worth just taking a look for comparison purposes. Since we did look at XME earlier, we could just take a look real quick at SLX. These are the steel stocks, and you can kind of see how this, again, was looking very strong to start the year, and that's looking very different from gold. You also have COPX, which has a bunch of copper miners in there. That one is, been struggling as well. Let's maybe shift to a discussion on tech, though. We kind of talked about this earlier. Seems like the NASDAQ is doing a lot better. It's the NASDAQ 100, as you mentioned, holding above the 200-day moving average line. A lot of this seems driven by tech. You've got the chips, you've got software. Where specifically kind of are you seeing the strength right now in the tech area?
Tech's been outperforming. So what I try to do is look at some of these industry groups, some of these ETFs, try to find those that have something that I could lean on as a buyer. Instead of buying something that's in the middle of a range, I like to maybe buy something that's either breaking out or it's retesting a breakout. And one of those that I'm looking at is XNTK, X-ray, no, Thomas, okay.
X-ray November Tango Kilo.
Tango, yeah, I had trouble finding a K. COSAR, how about that?
Yeah, there you go.
It was right in front of me, right? So you can see how we broke out on the right side of the screen, backed up to the 200-day moving average. In the meantime, it's outperforming. It's been outperforming SPY here. I'm looking at another chart. It's outperformed SPY by 10.2% since beginning of the year. It's now outperforming on an annual basis, on a 252-day basis, which is an annual basis. So you've got some good stuff going on there. The missing ingredient for me that I'm watching every day is those asset flows. I want those asset flows to come in, recognize that this is sitting on its 200-day moving average. It's outperforming, and it just broke out a couple of weeks ago. I see some expansion in those assets, and this will go on our list as an idea on how to participate in that space. And again, the big thing about this is if you buy it and you're wrong, we're really close to that 200-day moving average. So you don't have to risk a lot here underneath to potentially catch a move that can last a month or two. So that's the risk reward part of this that isn't necessarily a part of technical analysis, but it's a criteria that I need something to lean on. And this chart has that.
So, so John, why XNTK versus another one like XLK?
Well, actually, XLK shows similar. XLK is part of our CEF model, right? So I tend to let CEF take care of that. And then generally what I'll do is I'll look at smaller ETFs, subsets of that. And I look for trend, I look for relative outperformance, and I'll look for asset flows. So that's just kind of pulling up XLK. XLK has got very similar characteristics, you know, now that you mentioned it, but because it was getting covered, so to speak, by our CEF model, I was focusing in other places. But yes, okay. That's equally viable.
Okay. I mean, I thought maybe because XLK is heavily dominated by Microsoft and Apple, it looks like it has like 22% in each of those versus the XNTK, it's pretty evenly based. So it is interesting that they both kind of look like each other, though, too.
And for, it looks like for XNTK, you've got the biggest holdings. And again, it looks like the biggest holding is Meta Platforms at about 4.4% as of yesterday, March 14th. But you got Meta Platforms, NVIDIA, Salesforce, AMD, Airbnb, and so on. So, it's missing some of those NASDAQ components since it's focused on the NYSE. Very good. Did you want to take a look at the chips too? Because we were talking a little bit about chips. Is there an area to look at there? Or do you think that money's kind of flowing or indecisive here, I guess?
I'm looking at the stocks, and the reason I'm actually one of our ideas, current ideas right now is an XSD, X-ray Susan David. And the reason I didn't focus on it today for what we're talking about is the relative performance was quite good. Basically, from stocks outperformed the S&P 500 by a significant amount between, let's call it the very end of last year and beginning of February, outperformed by 16%. The relative performance line went relatively flat, edging up slightly, but the relative performance, it's been holding its own against the S&P 500, but really doesn't have that outperformance that you see in XLK or in NDX. So for what we're talking about today, I wanted to find the one that had the most, that had the most legs. So I think this is certainly viable. It's bumping up, the SOX is bumping up against some important resistance here around 3,200. And that's been the obstacle. It's the high that we made back in June of last year, and it's having a tough time getting through there. That high has held ever since then. So above 3,200, we might get some relative outperformance again, but it didn't quite make my list for today because it's been a relative performer versus the S&P for the past 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah. Well, this has been great talking with you again, John, and really appreciate you kind of going through what you're seeing out there. And, you know, just a reminder for folks that uncertainty, it's not necessarily the best time to be putting a lot of money to work when there is so much uncertainty. Usually better to wait for some of that trending to happen again. And certainly we'll be watching your stuff, John, to see if that ends up unfolding. So thanks a lot for being here today.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Okay. That's going to wrap it up for us this week. Please join us next week because we're going to have Ryan Warsh from Warsh Capital on the show. So we hope you join us for that. And thanks a lot for watching us and listening to us today. See you next time. make sure to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast if you haven't already. We'd really appreciate it. You can also send us your questions and comments to investingpodcast@investors.com. We would love to hear from you and may use your comments on an upcoming episode. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only, and nothing should be construed as a recommendation to buy, hold, or sell any securities. Make sure to consider consulting with your financial advisor before making any investment decisions.